Welcome to the Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson, and today we are providing an exhaustive, really granular report on the full 24 hours of American governance. We're looking at November 4th and carrying into the morning of November 5th, 2025.
Yeah.
This single period is, well, it feels like a moment in history where American governance truly hit a kind of critical mass. It's defined by institutional stress and, frankly, some pretty unprecedented action.
And I'm Sam Kennedy. And critical mass, I think that's exactly the right term, Alex.
Yeah.
If you look at the federal system right now, what you see is just extreme stress. And it's defined by three concurrent pressures all happening at once.
Right.
We're experiencing a record-breaking government shutdown, right? We just finished these really consequential off-year elections that, you know, really served as a national referendum. And then looming over absolutely everything, all the legislative activity, the executive action, is this massive challenge to presidential power that's arriving at the Supreme Court today.
That's the crossroads we really need to dissect here. Our mission today is to give you that shortcut to being well-informed by analyzing this single, incredibly packed day in detail. Because what the events of November 4th reveal, I think, is a fundamental reshaping of American power. You see how legislative gridlock, Congress literally failing to do its most basic job, funding the government.
Right.
How that's being strategically exploited by the executive branch for, well, what looks like an unprecedented expansion of unilateral authority. We promise to give you a comprehensive report on every implication we've seen since yesterday morning.
Yeah, and the sheer complexity of these crises unfolding simultaneously, you know, political, legislative, constitutional, it means that the actions taken just during this single day, which was defined by, you know, electoral defeat for one party, paralysis in Congress, and this looming judicial scrutiny. Well, these actions are likely going to set the trajectory for the next few years of governing in this country. So let's unpack the first of these seismic events, the mandate delivered by the electorate just last night.
Absolutely. We have to start there with the immediate political shockwave. The off-year election results that started dropping Tuesday evening. Our sources are confirming the overall outcome was, well, they're calling it a dominant sweep for the Democratic Party. And it really served as a clear, almost unmistakable public rebuke of the government shutdown and the, you know, the compounding economic pain it's inflicted nationwide.
And what's really fascinating here, I think, is where the public focus actually lay. You know, for months, the national media narrative, it was all dominated by themes like threats to democracy, right? Cultural flashpoints, national security risks. But the data, when you look at it, shows that the primary focus in campaign advertisements across these key races and the clear driver for the electorate, it came down to affordability and the cost of living.
It's basic economics.
Exactly. That palpable economic anxiety really sharpened by this prolonged shutdown, it seems to have completely superseded those other issues in the minds of voters making their choices.
And nowhere was that economic mandate clearer, I think, than in Virginia. That state provided the biggest win of the night with a truly historic statewide flip for the Democrats. Former Representative Abigail Spanberger, a Democrat, she decisively defeated Lieutenant Governor Winsome Earl Sears, the Republican candidate. So Spanberger is now poised to become the Commonwealth's first female governor.
Yeah.
And she did it, it seems, by focusing squarely on those kitchen table economics.
The Virginia contest was, well, it was undeniably the most direct referendum on the shutdown, wasn't it? I mean, given the Commonwealth's massive density of federal employees.
Right. Northern Virginia.
Exactly. Northern Virginia is basically the home of the federal workforce. And Spanberger was extremely effective in her campaign, focusing on affordability, yes, but also specifically defending those federal workers, defending them from both the administration's ongoing sort of structural cuts, you know, the whole Department of a Government efficiency campaign aimed at shrinking the civil service.
Right, that ongoing effort.
And critically, defending them from the immediate financial pain of just missing paychecks because of the shutdown.
And the exit polling really provides the hard evidence for this impact, doesn't it? Our sources show that a staggering 6 in 10 Virginia voters reported that federal workforce cuts had impacted their family financially. 6 in 10.
Oh.
And a full 2 in 10 said the impact was felt a lot. When 2 out of 10 people in your electorate feel a crisis a lot, well, that's a potent political force. The economic reality just outweighed everything else.
It really did.
Yeah.
And the Democratic sweep in Virginia was, well, it was comprehensive. It moved right down the ballot with some powerful symbolic victories, too. State Senator Ghazala Hashmi won the lieutenant governor race, achieving a really historic milestone.
Yeah.
She's become the first Indian person and the first Muslim woman to hold statewide office anywhere in the United States.
Incredible.
That adds this layer of diverse representation that, you know, clearly energized the Democratic base significantly.
And the sweep was completed when Democrat Jay Jones won the attorney general race. Now, the Jones victory is a crucial case study, I think, in the power of this economic mandate we're talking about. Because his candidacy was, well, it was heavily dogged by a massive controversy late in the race. Remember those resurfaced violent texts he had sent back in 2022?
Oh, yeah. That was quite something.
It became a national scandal. He was recorded wishing for political violence against a Republican opponent, comparing that opponent to figures like Hitler and Pol Pot. Really extreme stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that kind of rhetoric in almost any normal election cycle, that's usually fatal for a statewide candidate, right? Yet, despite the scandal getting intense national media coverage in the final week, that Democratic tide, fueled by the anti-shutdown sentiment, it just lifted him anyway. He won by a comfortable 6.5 points.
Yeah.
So the clear insight here for us, for you, the listener, is that the overwhelming anxiety and just the flat-out rejection of the shutdown's economic consequences completely superseded any, you know, cultural or personal scandals that might normally sway a moderate electorate. Economics trumped everything.
Okay, let's transition north then to the Garden State. New Jersey also delivered a major victory for Democrats. Representative Mikey Sherrill defeated Jack Ciattarelli for governor. Now, this was viewed as a critical win, securing ground for that moderate suburban wing of the Democratic Party in a state that, frankly, has been surprisingly volatile in recent off-year elections.
Mm-hmm. And the pre-election narrative of that race was deeply concerning for Democrats, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Well, Sherrill ultimately won by a pretty healthy 8 points in the early reports. The race had narrowed significantly toward Election Day.
Yeah, some polls had it down to just 1 or 2 points.
Exactly. So Sherrill's comfortable victory, it quickly quelled a lot of internal Democratic concerns about turnout, especially among Black and Hispanic voters. And that's partly because she managed to flip several key suburban counties that Ciattarelli had actually won just 4 years prior. Her success, it was really attributed to a relentless focus on property tax relief and local services, bread and butter issues.
But Election Day itself in New Jersey was, well, it was fraught with chaos. It adds this layer of concern about voter safety and potentially suppression. We saw widespread reports of multiple polling places temporarily closing in about 8 counties, I think, due to a coordinated wave of email bomb threats.
Yeah, it hit around 24 sites, many of them in schools or community centers, places you'd expect to be safe.
Right.
And New Jersey Attorney General Matthew Platkin was quick to call this an explicit attempt to suppress the vote. He emphasized that the non-credible nature of the threats was established pretty quickly, but the physical closure of sites, well, it created long lines. It discouraged voters who couldn't wait around for hours.
Yeah, exactly.
So law enforcement is now investigating these threats as potential interference. Could be foreign, could be domestic actors, basically anyone intent on sowing confusion and distrust in the process.
And just to add to the legal drama in New Jersey, the Republican National Committee, the RNC, supported an emergency lawsuit. They were trying to stop the counting of roughly 300 naked ballots in Bergen County.
Ah, the naked ballots.
Yes, those are the mail-in ballots that are missing the inner secrecy envelope. It's a technical defect, but it's become this recurring flashpoint in election integrity challenges.
Right. It just demonstrates that even small margins, minor procedural errors, they're now immediately met with these high-stakes legal challenges. No stone left unturned.
Okay. Now let's turn our attention to New York City, because that race provided perhaps the most ideological and, frankly, challenging outcome for the national Democratic establishment. Democratic Socialist Zohran Mamdani won the mayoral race. He defeated former Governor Andrew Cuomo, who ran as an independent, remember, and the Republican Curtis Sliwa.
Mamdani's win is, I mean, it's nothing short of a political earthquake within urban politics, isn't it? He's set to become the city's first Muslim mayor, its first millennial mayor. And it's an astonishing turnaround after polling in the low single digits just months ago. His success was driven entirely by mobilizing the progressive base around this really radical affordability mandate.
His pledges were ambitious, to say the least. Implementing free buses across the city, establishing universal, fully subsidized childcare programs.
Right, paid for by new taxes on millionaires. And establishing strict rent freezes. Big promises.
Very big. And this win immediately set up this fierce, high-stakes presidential feud. It elevated a local contest to a national power struggle.
Yeah, because President Trump had publicly endorsed Cuomo, which was a massive political statement in itself, endorsing a former rival.
Right.
And he called Mamdani a communist, going so far as threatening to withhold crucial federal funds from New York City if Mamdani was elected.
And that threat was significant for New York's budget, which is already strained, potentially risking the loss of, what, $7.4 billion in federal grants?
Yeah, money that funds everything from infrastructure to housing assistance. Critical funds.
But Mamdani's response was immediately and dramatically defiant. He vowed not to be intimidated. He promised to utilize every single tool at my disposal, including the courts and the bully pulpit, to make sure the city gets every dollar owed.
And he argued specifically, didn't he, that Trump's threats are merely the words of a president and not necessarily the law of the land, basically laying the groundwork for immediate litigation.
Setting up a fight.
Absolutely. And the Mamdani victory, it really highlights the profound internal battle happening within the Democratic Party itself. You had establishment figures, people like Senator Chuck Schumer, Representative Hakeem Jeffries. They were notably reluctant, or at best lukewarm, in their endorsement of Mamdani.
Right.
It just showcases the deep discomfort and the struggle between the party's moderate establishment and this energized new left, which, you know, successfully proved that this progressive economic messaging can actually win elections, even against established political dynasties like Cuomo.
Okay, one more election result to cover, and this was a major power play unfolding out west in California. Voters there approved Proposition 50. This was a controversial ballot measure allowing Democrats to bypass the state's independent redistricting commission for a one-time map redrawing, specifically ahead of the 2026 midterms.
Yeah, this is a massive legislative end run, really engineered by the Democratic leadership in the state. The proposition was framed, quite successfully it seems, as necessary self-defense against Republican gerrymandering elsewhere.
And the result. It's projected to give Democrats maybe four or five crucial House seat pickup opportunities in the 2026 midterm elections.
Explicitly designed, as you said, to counter those aggressive Republican gerrymandering efforts that have really consolidated GOP power in states like Texas and Florida. You know, Governor Gavin Newsom took a major political gamble by pushing for this special election and this proposition. And its successful passage significantly raises his national profile as a strategic opponent to the current administration. He played hardball and won.
And the White House reaction to Prop 50 was particularly telling, especially given its timing. President Trump publicly railed against the measure before the polls even closed in California.
Yeah, he called it a giant scam.
Right, a giant scam, and made these unsubstantiated claims that all mail-in ballots related to the measure were under very serious legal and criminal review. No evidence provided, of course.
None. And this sentiment was immediately echoed by the press secretary, Carol Ann Leavitt. She offered no evidence for the claims of blatant fraud, but she did confirm the White House is actively drafting a new executive order to strengthen our elections. And our sources indicate this draft order is specifically targeting mail-in voting requirements nationwide. It seems to be seeking to establish federal oversight, where states like California have heavily liberalized access. So this rapid response really confirms the administration views electoral rules themselves as a primary mechanism of political warfare. They're not waiting, they're acting.
So putting it all together from the elections, it seems pretty clear that the message delivered by the electorate on November 4th was overwhelming. The public is suffering from economic anxiety, and they are rejecting the political party currently seen as responsible for Washington's gridlock.
Yeah, that mandate seems crystal clear, which brings us almost paradoxically to the astonishing reality back in Washington, D.C. That political mandate demanding action on economic pain slams right into the legislative branch, which is completely deadlocked, utterly unable to respond to the public's clear directive.
It's incredible. On Wednesday, November 5th, today, the shutdown officially became the longest in U.S. history. We hit day 36.
36 days.
It's just a staggering display of institutional failure. Since the funding deadline passed weeks ago, the Senate failed again yesterday for the 14th time in recent weeks to pass the House-approved continuing resolution, H.R. 5371.
14th time.
Yeah. The roll call vote, number 603 of this Congress, it simply marked the continuation of, well, utter stagnation. Nothing's moving.
And the structural sticking point, it remains rigid. It's being driven by the Democratic minority, which controls 47 seats and is using the filibuster to enforce its demand.
Right.
They continue to require the inclusion of an extension for the Affordable Care Act subsidies, the ACA subsidies.
Critical subsidies.
Absolutely critical. They're set to expire at the end of 2025, and if they lapse, it would cause massive insurance premium spikes. Some estimates are over 40% increases.
Wow!
For millions of middle and lower income Americans who rely on that ACA marketplace for their health insurance.
Yeah.
It's a huge economic hit looming.
Meanwhile, the Republican leadership, including House Speaker Mike Johnson, they're insisting on a clean CR, no subsidies attached. They're maintaining the position that the shutdown is solely the fault of Democrats trying to, quote, hijack the necessary funding process for unrelated policy demands.
Right, that's the line.
But that internal unity, Republican unity, it seems to be fracturing under the pressure from those Virginia and New Jersey election results.
Yeah, we're definitely seeing tangible cracks appearing. GOP leaders have reportedly offered a public counterproposal. They're saying they'll hold a guaranteed future floor vote on the ACA subsidies.
A future vote.
A future vote, exactly. In exchange for Democrats agreeing to vote immediately to reopen the government with the clean CR, the one without the subsidies right now.
Mm-hmm.
And this proposition is reportedly under really tense debate among centrist Democrats, particularly those representing suburban districts that are sensitive to the ACA's popularity. They seem to be actively seeking some kind of political off-ramp that gives us cover.
Yeah, they need a way out. But even among Republicans, there's fundamental friction over the timeline for the next stopgap measure. Remember, the current CR expires in less than 3 weeks, November 21st.
Right. The clock is ticking.
So House Speaker Mike Johnson and the conservative faction, they prefer pushing the next deadline way out into January 2026.
Yeah.
And the strategy there seems aimed at retaining maximum leverage through the holiday season, forcing a series of short-term CRs, and thereby preventing Congress from passing one of those massive catch-all omnibus spending bills that conservatives hate.
That's exactly the key analytical point there, the fear of the omnibus. Because Senate Appropriations Chair Susan Collins, on the other hand, she's reportedly pushing for a mid-December deadline.
Earlier.
Much earlier.
Mm.
She and other appropriators, well, some insiders say they have omnibus PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder from past spending fights.
Mm.
Because pushing the deadline past Christmas, it increases the pressure and the political momentum to just combine all 12 appropriations bills into one massive multi-trillion dollar package.
Right.
And Republicans often feel that forces them to accept huge amounts of spending they oppose simply because nobody wants to be blamed for shutting the government down right before the holidays. So Johnson is trying to prevent that consolidation of leverage by keeping the deadlines short and early.
And beyond just the budget fight, the shutdown itself is being actively weaponized, it seems, to address fundamental Senate procedure. President Trump publicly urged Senate Republicans yesterday to terminate the filibuster now, to end the shutdown immediately. He's casting the procedural rule itself, the filibuster, as the source of the paralysis and Democratic intransigence.
So the administration clearly sees the shutdown as a political tool, not just to win this specific spending fight, but potentially to eliminate the minority party's primary procedural defense altogether, fundamentally rewriting the rules of the Senate.
A huge potential change.
Huge. However, Senate Republicans, including their leadership, they forcefully rejected this demand again yesterday. They're maintaining their traditional institutionalist opposition to removing the filibuster, probably recognizing that once it's gone, they too will lose the power to block future Democratic policies when they're in the minority.
Right. It cuts both ways. And this is where the executive branch's advantage becomes so clear during a shutdown like this. While the Senate was attempting and failing to negotiate, the House of Representatives wasn't even in session.
Nope.
They were designated for a district work period from November 3rd through the 9th. Just gone.
And that is the strategic inaction we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
By keeping the House gaveled out, keeping members absent from D.C., Speaker Johnson effectively prevents any potential compromise bill.
Yeah.
You know, maybe one crafted by a bipartisan group of moderate senators that includes the ACA extension from even being considered or brought to a vote in the House.
Right. Dead on arrival because there's no one there to receive it.
Exactly. It maximizes the pressure on Senate Democrats to simply capitulate and accept the existing preferred House CR. Meanwhile, the Republican leadership, even though they're absent from the floor, they maintain this constant stream of public statements solely blaming Democrats for the shutdown's spreading impact. The gridlock is actually functional for the executive's agenda right now.
So this legislative paralysis, it creates this political vacuum, right? And nature abhors a vacuum, as they say.
It certainly does.
Which leads us directly to the executive branch. Against this backdrop of a completely paralyzed legislature and those decisive electoral losses, the administration reacted with, well, hyperactive unilateral power plays. Especially in international trade and crisis management, it's demonstrating governance by executive fiat.
And here's where the timing becomes absolutely critical. Just hours, literally hours, before the Supreme Court was set to hear arguments challenging the president's unilateral tariff authority.
The IEPA case.
The IEPA case, exactly. Yep. The administration executed major international trade deals with China, all via executive order. And the White House explicitly described the arrangement not as a final peace pact, but as a truce, designed to mitigate some immediate tensions, perhaps for strategic reasons.
Okay, let's break down the details of this U.S.-China economic and trade arrangement. What did the U.S. give? Well, they offered key concessions that seemed designed to signal flexibility, maybe an important point for the Supreme Court to notice.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. lowered tariffs on certain Chinese imports, specifically those that were imposed to try and curb fentanyl production, by 10 percentage points. Furthermore, they extended certain Section 301 tariff exclusions until November 10th, 2026. And, critically for global trade, they paused responsive actions on China's maritime and shipbuilding sector for 1 year. So, some give there.
Right. And in return, China made significant tangible commitments in two really key areas, national security and agriculture. On the security front, they agreed to halt shipments of designated fentanyl precursors to North America. That's a big deal. And suspend the global implementation of new export controls on rare earths.
Also huge.
Crucial materials essential to U.S. defense technology. So this looks like a major diplomatic and security win on paper.
But the politically critical concession, you have to think, was aimed directly at the Farm Belt, a key electoral constituency for the administration.
Absolutely.
China suspended those retaliatory tariffs on U.S. agricultural goods, specifically soybeans, pork, corn, and beef that were imposed during the height of the trade war. And crucially, China committed to buy an enormous amount, 12 million metric tons, MMT, of U.S. soybeans in late 2025, and then dramatically increased that commitment to 25 MMT annually from 2026 through 2028.
Huge numbers.
This commitment directly shores up American farmers just days after the administration's party suffered those significant electoral losses, particularly in some agricultural areas.
Yet the strategic genius, or maybe the cynicism, depending on your perspective of this deal, lies entirely in its timing, doesn't it?
Seems that way.
The agreement was executed hours before the Supreme Court was scheduled to hear arguments challenging the legality of using the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, IEEPA, to impose these very tariffs in the first place.
Exactly. The administration is essentially creating real-time evidence for the Supreme Court. They're demonstrating, or trying to demonstrate, that the IEEPA tariff authority isn't just some rigid, blunt instrument of taxation,
right,
but a flexible, essential negotiating tool, one that can be used to extract major national security wins, get economic commitments from adversaries, and, importantly, can be reduced as well as imposed.
It's a pretty transparent attempt to preemptively undercut the challenger's arguments right before the most important constitutional hearing of the year.
Yeah.
They're showing the power being used dynamically.
And just as a necessary side note here, despite this major trade deal being touted as a game changer for farmers, the administration is concurrently planning a separate $12 billion market facilitation program, which is, let's be honest, effectively a farmer bailout.
Right, another bailout.
To be rolled out immediately after the shutdown ends. So this illustrates a pretty comprehensive two-pronged strategy. Secure the diplomatic success with China and guarantee direct financial relief to maintain political loyalty within that key demographic, covering all the bases.
Okay, moving from those proactive trade deals to more reactive crisis management. The shutdown created a massive domestic emergency. The USDA was forced to suspend November SNAP benefits, that's food assistance, for 42 million Americans.
42 million people. That's an immediate humanitarian crisis. And it triggered swift legal action with a coalition of 25 states and the District of Columbia fighting emergency lawsuits.
Yeah, and federal courts in Rhode Island and Massachusetts stepped in quickly. They ordered the USDA to utilize existing contingency funds to continue the benefits. The White House subsequently announced they would comply, but, and this is a major caveat, they would issue only partial benefits, about 50% of the full monthly amount. And this is where the political ambiguity and, frankly, the exploitation really began.
Because on the morning of November 4th, President Trump posted this deeply inflammatory message on Truth Social. He stated that SNAP benefits will be given only when the radical left Democrats open up government and not before.
Right.
This post created massive confusion, massive fear. It appeared to be in direct defiance of the court order and risked, you know, potential civil unrest. People were panicking.
Yeah. So White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt was forced into damage control mode pretty quickly. She claimed the administration was fully complying by issuing the partial payments. but she clarified that the president's post referred only to future benefits, or maybe full benefits, not the court-ordered partial ones.
A fine distinction.
A very fine distinction. And then she immediately pivoted, using the platform to explicitly blame Democrats for forcing the administration to tap the contingency fund in the first place, pointing out it only has about $5 billion available versus the $9 billion needed for full benefits. And then she explicitly urged recipients, people already experiencing financial distress, to call the Democrats and tell them to reopen the government.
Wow. So this entire sequence, you have the legal defeat, the minimal painful compliance with only 50% benefits, the presidential threat creating fear, and then the immediate political deflection.
Yeah.
It shows a deliberate, coordinated strategy, doesn't it? They seem to be weaponizing human need, reframing their forced compliance as some kind of magnanimous act of partial relief, while simultaneously maximizing the fear factor and aiming the political pressure directly at congressional Democrats who are already reeling from those election results.
It's a complex, maybe cynical, political maneuver using people's basic needs as leverage. We also saw several other high-profile personnel and policy decisions finalized during this period of hyperactive executive action. Perhaps the most illustrative was President Trump's decision to renominate the billionaire tech entrepreneur and private astronaut Jared Isaacman to be the next NASA administrator.
This is a remarkable, very public reversal, isn't it? The administration had abruptly withdrawn Isaacman's nomination back in May 2025.
Right.
A move that was widely reported at the time as being linked to a very public feud between the president and Elon Musk, who had strongly advocated for Isaacman's appointment.
And now the reversal follows a reported reconciliation between the president and Musk. And significantly, Isaacman himself had recently contributed at least $1 million to pro-Trump political action committees. Mm. The message seems pretty clear. Political access and favor are perhaps transactional and immediately available during a period of legislative paralysis when the president needs allies and maybe funding.
Okay. Shifting to the regulatory and civil service front, we're seeing concerted efforts to dismantle or control the administrative state. The Department of Homeland Security proposed a new, costly, and sweeping rule to expand the collection and use of biometrics by U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, USCIS.
Yeah, and critics immediately noted this rule would potentially include requiring biometrics, things like facial scans, fingerprints from some U.S. citizens, not just immigrants, greatly expanding surveillance powers under the DHS umbrella.
And as part of this broader strategy targeting federal workers, a new rule was issued barring student loan relief for public workers tied to any activity deemed illegal.
Right. And furthering this executive campaign against the civil service itself, the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, signaled that furloughed federal workers are not automatically entitled to back pay.
Despite the law.
Despite the 2019 Government Employee Fair Treatment Act, Jeff Toe, a law signed by this very administration, which explicitly guarantees back pay after shutdowns.
So how are they justifying that?
Well, legal experts immediately labeled this new OMB interpretation baseless. They see it as a unilateral attempt to nullify a clear statute passed by Congress. The rationale seems purely strategic. By signaling that furloughed workers risk losing their salaries entirely, the executive branch dramatically increases its leverage over the civil service. It makes them potentially powerful lobbyists against the shutdown and effectively threatens their financial security in all future appropriations fights.
So it's an act designed to undermine the neutrality and the stability of the federal workforce itself.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And finally, we noted this remarkable example of communications dissonance that almost borders on the absurd. The White House issued proclamations for things like National Native American Heritage Month. Okay, fine. But also, ironically, for Critical Infrastructure Security and Resilience Month.
Seriously.
This last proclamation, celebrating the supposed resilience of our infrastructure, was released on the exact same day the president's own transportation secretary was warning of impending air travel chaos because of the shutdown's impact on the FAA.
Wow. The disconnect is something.
It really is. It seems like a deliberate effort to project this false image of business as usual, even as critical national infrastructure is clearly teetering toward operational failure because of the funding lapse.
Okay, so all this unilateral executive activity, particularly that China trade deal signed just hours before the court hearing,
yeah,
it serves as a kind of prologue, doesn't it, to the judicial branch taking center stage. The Supreme Court is now poised to rule on the fundamental legality of the president's core economic powers. They're going to define the contours of the separation of powers, for decades to come. This is the impending Supreme Court tariff showdown with oral arguments scheduled for today, November 5th.
That's right. The case is Learning Resources v. Trump. It's consolidated with several related claims, and it challenges the legality of the president's repeated and extensive use of that 1977 law, the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, IEPA, to unilaterally levy billions and billions of dollars in tariffs against countries like China.
And the stakes couldn't be higher. A ruling against the president here would be devastating for his agenda. It would invalidate the core legal mechanism of his entire economic and foreign policy strategy built around tariffs.
It really would. And the constitutional heart of the debate, it hinges on Article 1 of the Constitution. That's the part that grants Congress the exclusive power to lay and collect duties, imposts, and excises. Taxes, basically.
The power of the purse.
The power of the purse. The challengers argue that IEPA, which was passed as an emergency measure primarily to control capital flow during international crises, it doesn't contain the word tariff or tax. And they stress that no president prior to this administration has ever used IEPA this way for broad, long-term trade taxation across entire sectors.
So what's the administration's counter-argument?
They counter by citing IEPA's power to regulate importation. And they argue that this phrase implicitly includes the power to tax imports. They're leaning heavily on a 50-year-old appellate court decision from the Nixon administration that upheld a temporary import surcharge under IEPA's predecessor law, the Trading with the Enemy Act.
But that historical comparison seems fraught with peril for the administration, doesn't it? The Nixon-era action was a 10% surcharge, explicitly temporary, just for a few months, and tied directly to a specific currency crisis.
Exactly. Critics argue that the current tariffs are effectively permanent, comprehensive taxes, a completely different legal beast. But the key legal dilemma here, I think, lies not so much with those old precedents, but with the current conservative majority's own favored legal tool, the Major Questions Doctrine. MQD.
Right. Let's clearly define that again for our listeners. The MQD, the Major Questions Doctrine, holds that for an administrative agency, or in this case, the executive branch, to adopt a policy of major economic consequence, and we saw this solidified in cases like West Virginia v. EPA, there must be clear, explicit authorization from Congress, not just vague, implicit text you can interpret. It has to be spelled out.
And tariffs imposing billions in costs globally are, well, undeniably a major economic action. And as the challengers emphasize, the authorization in IEPA regarding tariffs is definitely not explicit. The word isn't there.
So
the conservative justices face this profound institutional choice. Do they apply their own doctrine, the MQD, consistently, which would seem to necessitate striking down these massive tariffs imposed by a Republican president? Or do they create a significant carve-out specifically for muscular presidential power in the realm of foreign policy and trade, effectively admitting that the MQD is selectively applied depending on who is wielding the power?
That's a huge decision. The outcome of this case will redraw the separation of powers for a generation, and that's underscored, I think, by the expected attendance of Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent himself at the oral arguments today.
High stakes indeed.
Absolutely. And while that SCOTUS showdown loomed, the executive branch continued its legal war to dismantle the administrative state in the lower federal courts, notably targeting agencies they oppose, even those funded independently by Congress, like the CFPB.
Right, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. That battle is ongoing and significant.
It is. The Department of Justice filed a critical response yesterday in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals in a case called NTEU v. CFPB. They are actively opposing an on-bank rehearing by the full court. The administration's strategic goal here seems pretty clear. Finalize the ability to proceed with what are called reductions in force, or RIFs. These are essentially mass layoffs. Their stated intent is to fire nearly 1,400 employees. That's approximately 90% of the entire agency's staff.
90%. So if successful, this creates a detailed legal blueprint for the functional abolition of an entire agency, the CFPB, that the administration has long opposed, without requiring the difficult political lift of actually passing a repeal bill through Congress. It's deconstruction not through legislation, but through the deliberate application of personnel attrition and these legal maneuvers, effectively rendering the agency completely inoperable.
Exactly. Deconstruction by other means. We also saw the complexity of the Supreme Court's shadow docket, those emergency rulings, surface in the NIH lawsuit. This was filed by the American Public Health Association. This case challenged new administrative directives targeting specific types of research that the administration deemed politically objectionable.
Right. The lawsuit targeted the National Institutes of Health for deprioritizing research on what the agency itself defined as disfavored populations, specifically work-related to vaccines, diversity, equity, and inclusion, DEI initiatives, and LGBTQ plus health issues.
So the Supreme Court issued this fractured, kind of opaque ruling on its shadow docket. It's important to clarify the distinction they made because it's subtle but significant. They agreed to stay the lower court's relief only as it applied to funding terminations and contract issues. They basically argued those complex financial disputes have to go to a specialized court, the Court of Federal Claims, which handles government contracts. So they treated the funding purely as a contract issue, not a constitutional one. But critically, the Supreme Court did not stay the part of the ruling that set aside the NIH directives themselves, the actual policy documents saying these specific subjects should be deprioritized.
Okay. So what does that mean in practical terms?
It means the core policy of targeting specific communities for research deprioritization remains overturned by the lower court, at least for now. This limits the administration's ability to just abruptly halt research that's already mid-project, even while the complex funding disputes get shuffled off to this other court. It was a fractured decision, split 4-4 actually, highlighting the intense ideological tension. Justice Amy Coney Barrett was reportedly the decisive vote that split the ruling along these jurisdictional lines. So this legal battle is still very much active and proceeding in the First Circuit Court of Appeals. It's not over.
Okay, so these judicial challenges, the internal legal warfare, it all underscores the systemic stress caused by the legislative failure, by the shutdown. And when we look at critical agency operations, particularly in infrastructure, we are seeing real-world, potentially catastrophic failures emerging from this shutdown.
Yeah. And the most urgent, the most palpable warning came directly from the Transportation Secretary, Sean Duffy. He issued a stark public warning regarding the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA. He stated unequivocally, if the shutdown continues and air traffic controllers miss a second full paycheck next Tuesday, you will see mass chaos. His words.
Mass chaos. That's not subtle. How did he define that?
He defined it as mass flight delays, mass cancellations across the entire country, and potentially the closure of certain parts of the airspace, simply because the agency won't have the staffing to manage the volume safely.
Because the controllers are working without pay.
Exactly. Air traffic controllers are essential personnel. They are legally mandated to work without pay during a shutdown. And they are being stretched incredibly thin right now, pulling mandatory 10-hour shifts 6 days a week. We're hearing reports many are resorting to taking second jobs, driving for Uber or DoorDash, just to cover basic living expenses while they wait for back pay that might or might not come.
We've already seen the immediate disruptive impact, haven't we? Reports from major hubs like Newark just last Sunday detailed marathon-long security lines, multi-hour flight delays, all due to the stress on staff.
Yeah. But the most alarming part of Duffy's warning, for me, was the long-term impact. He warned the shutdown is actively damaging recruiting efforts. It's creating a severe and chronic workforce shortage problem for the FAA that's going to persist long after this funding lapse finally ends.
Right. It's just making the profession untenable. Who would sign up for that?
Exactly. Why would new recruits sign up for an essential job where they might not get paid for weeks or months on end?
Okay, shifting gears slightly to foreign policy and defense. The executive branch continues to operate its military and security campaigns with notable autonomy, largely unfettered by congressional oversight during this gridlock.
Yeah. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth announced the 16th deadly strike on an alleged drug boat in the Eastern Pacific. This strike killed two people, bringing the campaign's total death toll now to at least 66.
66 killed.
Yeah. And this aggressive, sustained counter-narcotics campaign, it continues without any explicit congressional authorization for the use of military force. It's operating under existing authorities, but without a new AUMF.
Hegseth also highlighted some key international relations moves. He praised South Korea for committing to significantly increase its defense spending and enhance cooperation on U.S. warship maintenance.
Which reflects the administration's America First policy, right? Pressuring allies to contribute more to their own defense.
Exactly. And concurrently, U.S. Central Command validated the Iraqi Security Forces' capacity to independently manage their combat strike process. This marks a major intentional transition milestone in handing over security responsibility in that region.
However, the internal friction at the Pentagon, that tension between the military branch and its civilian leadership and oversight, seems to be reaching a breaking point. The Senate Armed Services Committee, SSC, publicly criticized Pentagon leaders yesterday for unilaterally reorganizing the policy shop without consulting Congress at all.
What happened there?
They found out that the title of a key nominee, Austin J. Dahmer, had been changed without notice. And significantly, oversight of that critical security partnership involving Australia and the UK was shifted out of his portfolio after his nomination hearing, circumventing the traditional confirmation and oversight process.
So they felt blindsided.
Completely blindsided. SC leaders expressed extreme frustration over the lack of transparency and just the difficulty they're having reaching the Undersecretary of Defense for Policy, Elbridge Colby. But the most significant point here is the explicit executive effort to shut down dialogue. Defense Secretary Hegseth has formally barred all Department of Defense personnel from communicating with Congress on a list of restricted topics.
What kind of topics?
Things like the National Defense Strategy, budget specifics, acquisition reform, unless they are specifically cleared beforehand by legislative affairs.
Wow, that's a massive impediment to congressional oversight.
It is. It leverages the legislative paralysis, the shutdown, to ensure the Pentagon has a much freer hand in military strategy and spending decisions away from congressional scrutiny.
Okay. In terms of other federal operations, the cascading impacts of these staffing shortages are spreading beyond just infrastructure like the FAA.
Yeah. The Social Security Administration was forced to close several field offices yesterday across multiple states. The reason given, due to limited staffing, because non-essential workers are furloughed during the shutdown.
And this denies critical in-person access to elderly citizens, low-income individuals, people with disabilities who rely on those local offices for help.
Exactly. Conversely, though, it is important to note that some regulatory functions continue completely unabated. It confirms that the business-facing regulatory state remains highly functional even when the government is technically closed.
Like what?
Well, for instance, the EPA published a final rule in the Federal Register yesterday. Significant new use rules on certain chemical substances, 24 to 4.5E. It just proves that the machinery of environmental and chemical regulation continues its work, regardless of the appropriations lapse for other parts of the government.
Okay. And finally, we must note a tragic domestic incident that occurred amidst all this systemic stress yesterday.
Yeah, sadly. A UPS cargo plane carrying three crew members crashed shortly after takeoff in Louisville, Kentucky.
Terrible.
It killed at least seven people on the ground and caused an extensive fire that consumed two adjacent businesses. The National Transportation Safety Board, the NTSB, has taken the lead on the investigation into this catastrophic air incident. Just a stark reminder of the fragility of the complex systems we rely on every day.
Absolutely terrible news. So, as the nation is grappling with this extraordinary confluence of events, political gridlock, expanding executive power, constitutional scrutiny, we really must pause for just a moment of national reflection. Because Monday, November 4th, also saw the death of former Vice President Dick Cheney. He died at the age of 84 due to complications stemming from pneumonia and his long battle with cardiac and vascular disease.
Yeah. And Cheney's legacy is, well, it's immense, it's complicated, and it remains deeply polarizing, doesn't it? He is historically remembered as one of the most powerful and certainly at times most feared vice presidents in U.S. history. He fundamentally transformed that office, the vice presidency, into this nexus of influence, sometimes manipulation. He operated as the chief relentless architect of the Iraq War and expanded presidential powers in ways that continue to echo today.
He was a figure who fundamentally believed in a strong, unilateral executive, often operating outside the traditional channels of government bureaucracy. His influence on the legal justifications for things like surveillance, the war on terror, it expanded the parameters of what a modern president could achieve. And that legacy, ironically, finds itself under immense scrutiny by the Supreme Court this very week in that IEPA tariff case we were just discussing.
That's a really potent irony, isn't it? And perhaps the most potent irony of his passing, especially in the context of this current administration, is the political chasm he occupied at the end of his life. Cheney, this hard-charging, foundational conservative figure, had publicly broken entirely with the sitting Republican president. He called the current president the greatest threat to our republic.
Yeah, I remember that.
And in an astonishing political twist, he endorsed the Democratic candidate, Kamala Harris, in the 2024 election. It just illustrates the deep fracturing within the traditional Republican establishment that he helped build.
And the administration's official response to Cheney's death was quite revealing of this frosty relationship, wasn't it?
Very revealing. The White House offered no public condolences, no personal tributes. They confirmed that flags were lowered only because it was strictly required by law for a former vice president.
stark contrast to the moving tributes from figures like his former boss, George W. Bush.
Absolutely. But it perfectly reflects the deep, bitter feud between the current administration and the Cheney family, particularly his daughter, former Representative Liz Cheney, who became a leading critic.
Okay, so let's try to synthesize all of this. Looking across these events from the last 24 plus hours, the decisive electoral mandate, the absolute legislative gridlock, the hyperkinetic executive action, what does it all mean?
Well, you see a truly interconnected system under just enormous strain. The massive political defeat suffered by the administration's party in the elections, driven by that public rejection of the shutdown's economic pain, it puts immense and immediate pressure on Republicans to find an off-ramp. It likely forces a compromise on those ACA subsidies sooner rather than later, I would think. The political reality demands it now.
And that pressure to end the shutdown, it creates a complex environment for the other branches too, right? It might perhaps subtly influence the Supreme Court's willingness to grant the president these broad unilateral economic powers in the IEPA case.
How so?
Well, the court knows the financial instability and the political chaos it would create if they suddenly struck down the core mechanism of the administration's entire trade policy. But on the other hand, doing so would enforce that major questions doctrine principle they've so aggressively championed against other administrations. It's a balancing act for them.
Yeah, it is. And the contrast throughout this period is just stark and maybe dangerous. On November 4th, you saw the executive branch moving mountains, executing massive China trade deals, maneuvering for legal advantage at the Supreme Court, seeking to functionally abolish agencies like the CFPB.
Right. Action, action, action.
While simultaneously, the legislative branch remained completely locked down, failing even to pay its own workers, forcing those chaos warnings from the transportation secretary. This contrast creates a dangerous vacuum of governance where unilateral executive authority is becoming, perhaps by default, the only functioning mechanism.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener, trying to make sense of it all? We've seen the executive branch, yes, move mountains on things like the China trade deal, the IEPA maneuvering, but we've also seen it simultaneously weaponizing human need, the S&IP crisis, to gain political leverage over congressional Democrats. So as the Supreme Court begins to decide this IEPA tariff case, they are effectively holding the future of presidential power in their hands. They're defining how much a president can achieve without Congress. Will the justices ultimately see that tariff authority as a flexible, essential negotiating tool that maybe safeguards national security? Or will they deem it an unconstitutional expansion of power, violating that core principle of separation of powers?
And the precedent they set now, in this specific atmosphere of legislative failure and executive assertiveness, it will absolutely define the relationship between the White House and Congress for the next generation. It will determine whether gridlock permanently expands the power of the chief executive, fundamentally altering our system of government.
Absolutely. A pivotal moment. Thank you for joining us for this incredibly deep dive into the federal news update for Wednesday, November 5th, 2025. We'll see you next time.